Hey Chicago, it's Nudia Hernandez from Vocalo. Taylor Bennett and A Damn Killer will be joining me for Vocalo's Summer Meltdown concert on July 11th at Bottom Lounge. It's free and the good vibes are endless. For more, head to wbez.org/events.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to the very end of the episode to get a rundown of the latest news. But first, we're talking about reparations. That's, of course, been a hot-button issue across the country since the abolition of slavery back in 1865. But you'll remember calls for reparations programs grew much louder in the wake of the 2020 uprising for Black Lives. And that's when leaders in Evanston also worked to create a first-of-its-kind reparations program to pay back Black residents harmed by generations of housing discrimination. But now that program is at the center of a major legal battle. The Trump administration suing the city of Evanston, arguing that the reparations program is unconstitutional. While Evanston officials say this program's not only lawful, but it's necessary. So what implications could this lawsuit have far beyond Evanston? In this episode of the pod, we will dig into the suit and we'll discuss what it could mean for the future of reparations. At the table with me was Robin Rue Simmons, founder and executive director of First Repair, Mayor Daniel Biss from the city of Evanston, and Kimberly Holmes Ross, who's a Descendants Reparations recipient and executive director of Evanston Cradle to Career. That is a group of organizations committed to realizing a more fair and equitable community in Evanston. I want to start with you, Robin, because when that lawsuit was first filed back in 2024, this is Flynn A. Al versus the city of Evanston, you told the Tribune that you weren't surprised at the time. So I want to flash forward to now and talk to me. Are you surprised now that the Department of Justice is now intervening in this?
Not at all. And whenever I did that interview, I probably added that when we began this work in Evanston in 2019, our law department and outside legal support was our greatest priority, my greatest priority, expecting that we would be attacked. Not at all surprised of the escalation and the timing of it, because we are achieving repair in Evanston. As you mentioned, we have dispersed $7.3 million to over 300 residents, and our city has inspired a movement for other localities. So this lawsuit is not just against Evanston. It is more so against the movement for reparations to set a new precedent in the way that Evanston set a precedent that repair could be done.
Yeah, I see that. I see it that way, too. This is extending far beyond Evanston, or so it feels.
Definitely.
So far.
There's no question.
Kimberly, did you think that things would go this far, the DOJ stepping in here?
Actually, I didn't. I didn't think, you know, Trump would have time for little old Evanston. but yeah, I didn't. So, you know, it's just another way to really, you know, bully people and you know, think that others should not do this. So I'm really hoping, you know, that we can just stand, you know, for reparations. But yeah, I was surprised, unlike Robin.
Yeah. Mayor Biss, talk to us about what exactly it means right now that the Department of Justice is intervening. And why do you think they're doing this now?
Let me answer the last question first. I have no idea what's in these folks' heads. And I don't know why now. This program has been up and running for years. This lawsuit that the feds and the Trump administration are joining has been around for years itself. I don't know. Reparations was in the newspaper recently, and I think they love chasing attention around like a cat with a toy. This is an effort to intimidate, right? What Robin is too modest to tell you is that since Evanston, as a result of her leadership, launched our reparations program that I do believe was carefully designed and consistent with legal principles and critical for us to repair the harms that we as a community caused. Since that occurred some years ago, hundreds of people have come to Evanston from municipalities, from states, from other organizations, from other countries to try to emulate this, because there is a growing movement of people trying to figure out what they can do to repair the harms they caused. And this is an effort by the Trump administration to tell anybody who's interested, back off. We're going to come for you.
Mm-hmm. you touched there on just sort of the careful design of this program. So I want to hear from both of you on this. I'm going to turn to you, Robin, because you know, you had a hand in creating this, mm-hmm. right? Tell us more about your role in First Repair, your
Absolutely.
Organization.
I would say that I'm here with my hat as chairwoman of the Evanston Reparations Committee right now. And I have some local, national, and global roles in the reparation space. But at that time, I knew that I didn't know enough about crafting a legal framework that would be viable and constitutional that we could implement. And so we had not only our city attorneys, but others that have supported that effort, learning best practices for reparations and understanding that it is a human right, it's not civil rights, learning how we could practice and model repair in every step of the process, making sure that we didn't engage in any process racism in the application process, mm-hmm. engaging our public library to help with understanding the eligibility, a lot of info sessions that were held in safe community spaces like Black churches and community centers in town. And a lot of public education, not just for our community, our stakeholders, our allies, and also our elected. So yeah. Evanston was incredible that the city council had closed session training to understand our own history of anti-Blackness in the city. Mm-hmm. And it, ultimately, there was a particular policy, a zoning law. And so this isn't solving for all the crimes against the humanity of people that have been enslaved. This is specifically Evanston and specifically a zoning law from 1919 to 1969 that the city is acknowledging was harmful and stripped away wealth and opportunity from its community.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, when I hear you sort of go through that, it sounds like a careful, just a measure of making sure that you do your homework mm-hmm. and implement this in the right way. And then here we are, right? This
yes.
is the result of doing all that work. Mm-hmm. Kimberly, let's talk more about the harm. Can you help illustrate that for our listeners? Because you are a fourth generation, lifelong Evanstonian. What did you witness?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to go back to really quick where my grandparents came here in 37. And I talked about working on the place. They came from Tennessee during the Great Migration for a better, you know, life. And they came right to the Fifth Ward to work on the North Shore, you know, as domestics and chauffeurs and things like that. And were directed right to the Fifth Ward. Fast forward, when my parents met and got married and wanted to buy a home, it was the only place they could buy was in the Fifth Ward. So I grew up in the Fifth Ward, and it was a great place to grow up. I saw the harm when the disinvestment started, mm-hmm. when the hospitals began to leave, the banks began to leave, the library left, the community center left. So as you witness the disinvestment, that's the harm I witnessed firsthand.
Yeah.
I think our ancestors just didn't have a choice. So we talk about that kind of harm and not having other places to go. But for me, just witnessing the disinvestment was, you know, the harm I saw.
Yeah. And so you're a recipient, as I mentioned, of some of the funds, right? We talked about how so far more than $7 million has been distributed. What inspired you to apply in the first place, Kimberly? Okay.
I have to tell you, my mother inspired me to apply. My mother is a former council member, and she went around town inspiring everyone to apply. Her church groups, her senior groups, she got the library to come and help people with eligibility and, you know, and finding documents.
So and you're talking about the late Dolores Holmes.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. And so she was so, you know, inspired by, you know, this happening that she got everyone to apply. And as an ancestor, she did not even apply for herself. So I did apply. I received the funds. And in her honor, we invested it back in my parents' home and did some, you know, small renovations there just in her honor. But yes, she was the inspiration.
Yeah. So, Mayor Riss, the funds are dispersed by the city of Evanston. Who is eligible for the payments exactly, just so we're clear, and how is that determined?
So as Robin described, we're talking about a specific documented period of time, 1919 through 1969, during which the city engaged in really concrete acts that reverberate today, right? And by the way, and I do want to say it's really touching that here we are talking with Robin Rue Simmons, who is the council member from the Fifth Ward, immediately after Dolores Holmes of blessed memory, who's Kimberly's mother. You know, and I think about the what used to be Ms. Holmes' home on McDaniel, a street, by the way, which is now has an honorary street naming after Ms. Holmes. I think about that home and the way in which the city deliberately disinvested in parks near that home, deliberately did not maintain streets and sidewalks near that home, deliberately continued to not provide adequate public services, which then resulted in decline in other kinds of services like hospitals and so forth. And then when the family goes to sell that home, it's worth less than it would be if the city had made those investments.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're seeing is the actions the city took, yes, between 1919 and 1969, have a direct, concrete, financial negative impact today on the descendants of individuals who were in Evanston then. So, which is to say, for Black residents of Evanston who either were residents of Evanston during those years or are descendants of those who were, or who otherwise can directly prove harm as a result of discriminatory actions taken by the city of Evanston, they are eligible for our program.
Hey, if you're just tuning in, this is In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. The U.S. Department of Justice is joining a lawsuit that challenges the city of Evanston's reparations program. So we're digging into it with Robin Rue Simmons, who's chairwoman of Evanston's Reparations Committee and founder and executive director of First Repair, Mayor Daniel Biss of the city of Evanston, and Kimberly Holmes Ross, who's an Evanston Descendants Reparations recipient. Now, we invited U.S. Attorney Andrew Boutros to join the conversation. However, he wasn't available. And since the case is pending, his team opted not to provide a statement. Tell us what you're hearing, Robin, from other recipients. Of course, we've been hearing from Kimberly. How are they feeling about the program?
Well, first of all, the amount of support that we're getting from the community and beyond Evanston is extraordinary. There's a recent letter of support condemning the actions of the DOJ by the Congressional Black Caucus, and many others that have provided written support. Our community is furious. They're upset. Even those that have not been actively engaged in sort of the process of reparations are now saying, what can I do to stop this? Because this is not justice. This is our city. We are doing what we can do in our home rule. Little bitty town of 75,000, like this is an attack on us and we're not going to stand for it. So mm-hmm. the community, of course, are going to be concerned. So we have 308 that have been dispersed, but there are a few hundred more that are pending their disbursement. So, of course, there's concern about what does this mean for my direct benefit? And we, you know, continue, the city since the lawsuit was filed in 2024 has continued to disperse and will continue to disperse from what my understanding and period. Yeah. I'll let that be a period. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Now, Mayor Biss, in this suit, they claim that the reparations program violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Rights Clause. Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon said, quote, "There are sound ways for a city to remedy past discrimination or direct resources to its most vulnerable citizens and neighborhoods. Simply handing out money based on race, however, is not the answer." Your response?
Well, it's actually really comforting to hear that someone in the Trump administration thinks there are ways to repair harm because that's not visible from their actions. I would just repeat what I've said before. The city dug deep in our history. We worked with scholars to understand what we've done. We documented real harm that not only happened in the past, but is being felt right now by residents of Evanston. Let me give you another example. There are two adjacent census tracts in Evanston, and those census tract borders pretty much match the old redlining segregation borders. There are two adjacent census tracts where the life expectancy is different by 13 years. So these acts took place. They've been documented by historians. They're being felt today by our residents, and we've designed a program carefully to address that. And I would just say I think that's what all municipalities should do.
Yeah. So, you know, Robin, I want to hear from you too, right? Because first, you looked at the mayor when I read that portion that talked about, you know, handing out money based on race is not the answer. has the federal government made clear what they believe is the answer here? Have they suggested alternative ways that Evanston or other cities can right these kinds of wrongs?
They have not. And wouldn't it be fitting for them to do that as we go into commemorate 250 years of this sovereign nation? That would have been a nice way to celebrate with justice and repair. So we're not there. But I will add that whatever suggestions they may have proven insufficient. And that's how I came to this in 2019. We have been doing great equity work. We had been doing work by census tract. And until we address the harm in a targeted way, in the same way that Jim Crow was targeted, in the same way that redlining was targeted, in the same way that this particular zoning law was targeted, we will continue to have the racial gaps that we have right now. And so even with all of the remedies that were suggested by the federal government, we in Evanston had that 13-year life expectancy gap, also about a $60,000 household income gap, maybe more now since the impact of COVID. And all of our other livability standards have us racially divided with the Black community at the lower end. You can drive through Evanston and see where the segregation and the impact is. My neighborhood, where Kimberly and I grew up, inferior infrastructure. Right now, today, we're just now receiving lead replacement for our water main services. And so what I want to share with you is that beginning the process of reparations has begun to repair our city beyond even what the community, the committee has done, because now we're looking at many things with a reparative lens. And so even though the lead pipe not necessarily coming through the reparations committee, but we're paying more attention now that our community has been well-educated, in part with the help of Shorefront Legacy Center and others, in how we have oppressed, how we have been disadvantaging our Black community, and how we've been sustaining that. And our community said, we want to live within our values. We want to govern within our purview and within our values. And a way to do that is reparations in a viable constitutional way, one that is using home rule taxes. These are not federal dollars. These are home rule taxes.
Right.
And shame on the government.
So, Kimberly, tell me what this action by the Trump administration signals to you, because looking ahead, if they're successful here with this lawsuit, what do you think this could mean for future reparations program recipients?
Well, I think it'll probably deter people from, you know, seeking reparations. And, you know, it's really, again, a form of bullying. The government wants to gaslight us and pretend like history, you know, really didn't happen. So, you know, it will be detrimental. So, you know, we're really hoping that this does not go anywhere. And this is just another one of the antics, but it will be detrimental. But I'm like Robin, we are strong and we are resilient and we are a proud community, and we do have lots of folks behind us. So, you know, we're strong. So we're not too worried.
What do you want to see happen next, Mayor?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important that we stand strong, that we continue to fight. I think that part of how we got here is that we made a choice. Robin Rue Simmons made a choice. The city council made a choice. And critically, the community made a choice that said, we are not going to continue to act like this is somebody else's problem. Like, it's a real disappointment and a shame that we have these massive inequities, even though we did something to cause them. And hopefully somebody else will fix it, because it's too hard, it's too controversial, it's too risky. Instead, we chose to take on this problem head on, not to complete the work of solving it, but to say, hey, we own it and we're going to do our best and we're going to start to take concrete steps. And I think in this world right now, where so few governments are willing to do that, it's a very clear signal from the Trump administration to say, if you stand up and try to actually fix something, we are going to punish you.
Yeah.
And it's really critical for us to stand strong and to not back down and to fight and to win.
We'll keep an eye for sure. But while I have you here, and as we wrap, Mayor, I want to touch on the fact that you recently announced that you're going to be leaving office, the office of mayor, on October 18th. It's going to trigger a special election next spring to vote in your successor. So just with a few months left in this particular role, tell us your top priorities.
Well, in Evanston, housing is always really critical, related to this conversation, right? And we have a community that calls itself diverse and is diverse, but not every neighborhood is fully diverse. And so we're trying to change our zoning laws and to make sure that we have diverse housing stock in every single neighborhood to allow legacy families to continue to afford to be in Evanston and to allow people to come and to enable our community to continue to thrive.
We'll leave it there for now. That's Mayor Daniel Biss of the City of Evanston. We've also been talking with Robin Bruce Simmons of First Repair and Kimberly Holmes Ross, who is a Descendants Reparations recipient. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
For sticking with us, now we'll turn to the top news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ Arts and Culture reporter Courtney Kippers, and Chicago Sun-Times reporter Violet Miller. It is hot out there.
Hot,
it continues
so
to be
hot.
It's going to be 95 today. Is anyone else loving this?
You're loving this?
I mean,
I'm
a summer
sarcastic
girl.
She's being sarcastic.
No, I'm a summer girl.
Oh, you like the humidity with the real feel, the heat index at 110?
I like the
you like the idea. You like the idea of it not being winter, which is fair. I think
like,
that's the thing in Chicago we have to remind ourselves.
I like these 2 months of sanity.
Last
because
so hot. Lovely.
The
last
other
totally.
Day.
So
oh
nice.
My god.
Yeah.
Agree. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And just keep that up.
Yes. So you're over it, Courtney?
I don't know. I really want to go to the beach, but then it's going to start raining when it's the weekend. So that's got me a little sad.
Yeah. Well, every day kind of feels a little bit like the same. But what is the city trying to do right now to ensure that we're out there and we're safe, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, it's doing what it often does, which has cooling centers open across the city. Most are available between 8 and 9 in the morning to about 5 across the city. Also, you know, in neighborhoods, you see a fire department sort of turning a blind eye to the hydrants being messed with, and you see spraying water out, kids, dogs, birds, everybody partaking in water being sprayed. Pools are open, as Courtney mentioned, beaches are open, but yeah, a lot of public buildings, field houses, any public building with AC is wide open and available for anybody that's looking for relief.
Mm-hmm. Advocates argue Chicago's response should ensure vulnerable residents have access to cooling at night after sundown. Mayor Johnson's administration didn't immediately replied to a request for comment. Right?
Yeah, we're seeing this in the Sun-Times this morning. You know, heat waves often hit populations on the south and west sides the hardest. So having a cool place at night, you know, can really be a challenge for some of these people, especially when we've been seeing no relief at night. You know, lows this week have been consistently around 81, 82 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So advocates are sort of saying, great, thank you for having the cooling centers open, but during the day, but, you know, we need some options for nighttime because people are very uncomfortable and vulnerable populations,
sure.
You know, are at risk
it's
at this point.
It's still very humid
after
the sun goes down. You know, a great place to wait out the heat, Courtney?
Yeah.
The movie theater.
True. Very true.
Chicago's historic Music Box Theater is expanding, so tell us more.
Yeah. Over the weekend, the theater debuted its brand new third screen. This is in addition to its main theater that's been there for nearly a century. And so this new third screen is housed within its same Lakeview building. It's a brand new theater, but it's still got that same sort of historic charm. And it's really sort of notable because a lot of movie theaters are struggling right now, but Music Box is expanding.
Mm-hmm. And Violet, we are coming off of the last day of Supreme Court opinions for the term. Now, in a 6-3 decision, the justices ruled that states can bar transgender girls and women from playing on girls and women's sports teams. But that's not exactly happening in Illinois, right?
Yeah. So I actually just got off the phone with IHSA Executive Director Craig Anderson immediately before we hopped on the air. And he said, you know, nothing's changing in Illinois because that would require the Illinois state law to change. And Illinois state law says trans women and girls should have access to, you know, sports just the same as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously this decision is going to impact at least 25 states in which, you know, these laws do exist, keeping them out. And so, you know, again, not the local impact, but nationwide and morale-wise, it's definitely a hit.
Yeah, often the case for us, right, being sort of the safe haven while the rest of the country just is going through it.
And it could be another situation where you have families that are choosing to move into states like Illinois so that their kids can feel safe in their bodies practicing, you know, the things that they enjoy the most, like sports.
Here's the thing at the core of this whole argument, Violet. I mean, many critics of transgender girls playing on girls' sports teams, they argue that it's not fair. What are advocates saying about that, though, in response?
Yeah. So I think just at the top, we got to remember that, like, these are children. And we're talking about kids, a lot of the time middle schoolers. If we're talking close to home in this, you know, again, quote unquote, safe haven state. I mean, even a trans girl runner at Naperville District 203 last year was the source of, you know, upheaval and news and lawsuits that, you know, we reported on a few weeks ago. But to get into this, you know, they say that it's not fair. They say that, you know, these trans girls have been exposed to testosterone through puberty and thus, you know, have this unfair advantage. But the science doesn't really back that up. There isn't a lot of good research on trans folks because people don't tend to want to, you know, fund studies on trans people. But Oxford researchers just 2 years ago, in a study published in the Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism, found it took just 2 years on hormone replacement therapy for trans women to be matching cis women hormonally, and that's in adults. So obviously, again, this is very different for children when they are either prepubescent or early stages of puberty, and so that can change a lot. But, you know, they were seeing just after a few years of this, even in the much shorter term, you see these effects where muscle mass is decreasing, fat is redistributing.
Right.
And, you know, this isn't something that I get into a ton on these shows, but, like, I myself am a trans woman, for listeners who don't know. I have experienced this muscle mass loss. I was, like, 180, 190 pounds for most of my life until I got on this, and I mean, dropped 60 pounds in muscle mass despite, I mean, 4 days a week in the gym, really trying to keep that up. So there is a very, very real impact. And as these Oxford researchers said, you know, there needs to be more studying on this, but the answers are very clear.
Yeah, that was very important context. Thank you for sharing, Violet. Something else we were watching yesterday with the Supreme Court opinions coming down, Claire, is that other 6-3 ruling where justices ruled to uphold birthright citizenship. It's enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, will remain that way. What's the local response been?
Well, politicians here seem pretty happy, especially, you know, in Chicago and in Illinois, where a loss for Trump is often a win for our governor and our mayor because, you know, how they govern is very different from how the Trump administration tends to govern. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker saying that their decision reaffirms the foundational values of America, and also continuing his sentiment that here in Illinois, we're going to remain active and vigilant and standing up for the Constitution. Local advocates are very... esteemed reporter Adriana Cardona Magigad was in a lot of different communities, Venezuelan communities yesterday, talking to Chinese immigrants. And people say that they feel a sense of relief, but also that it's a little bit bittersweet. Some advocates say while they're celebrating, you know, the victory of the ruling, they are going to stay very active and keep organizing because they worry about further attacks on immigrant communities, that this is not going to stop here and that they're ready.
We are only a year and a half into this administration, folks. There's a lot more time to go. Now, Courtney, over to you, because you just reported on a new economic impact study from Arts Alliance Illinois. Talk to us about what it says about the state of the creator sector here in the state.
Yeah, the report found that the creative sector is Chicago's third largest industry and accounts for nearly 213,000 jobs in the city. And that includes workers in arts education, design, performing arts. So lots of different folks included in this count. And it's really an attempt by the creative sector to have hard data to sort of back up and make the case for additional funding and resources for the sector to really be able to say to lawmakers and others, hey, we are a major player when it comes to the state and city's economy.
And here's the thing, the study doesn't take so-called gig workers into account, which I found very interesting because I imagine gig workers play a fairly significant role here in the arts.
Totally. Yeah. Claire Rice, who's the executive director of Arts Alliance Illinois, said the count is sort of intentionally conservative. They know they have missed people. It doesn't account for gig workers or people who are doing this as a side hustle, which is a lot of folks, as you thought there. And she said the available data is very hard to capture the whole community of creative workers, but said that this is sort of a good baseline data for future research.
In other news, Violet, Governor Pritzker issued a disaster proclamation. This is after the recent storms and tornadoes. What should we know?
Yeah, so the disaster proclamation, I mean, this is pretty standard fare after we get this severe weather coming through here. But the governor noting that, you know, we've had a large amount of severe weather this year. So the disaster proclamation reaches all the way back to those tornadoes back in March in Kankakee that were, you know, very, very destructive. Even it killed a person. And so, you know, if you want the full list of storms that are included in this, it goes all the way, again, from March through June. That's on our website at suntimes.com. We've got a story up on that. But this opens up state resources, state funds, equipment, personnel to help with the recovery effort, just making sure that's kind of speeding up, moving along so folks can get their homes back.
Mm-hmm. What other stories are you watching, Claire?
Well, lots of people, no surprise, are traveling for the 4th of July
yes,
holiday.
Yes, always.
Well, isn't it that time of year?
It's also the World Cup, so you've got people totally. Traveling all across the country, into Canada, into Mexico, but O'Hare says it is preparing yet again for its busiest travel period. I think we broke the record Memorial Constantly. Day travel period. Now they're anticipating that again for 4th of July. Mm-hmm. A Chicago Department of Aviation says it's likely going to see 2 million passengers between O'Hare and Midway throughout this weekend. As we know, the federal holiday is going to be observed on Friday, so lots of people will have that day off. The 4th of July is going to be on a Saturday, but O'Hare is anticipating that Sunday will be its busiest day, 300,000 expected passengers passing through O'Hare.
And I will not be one of them.
Midway, a little more chill.
I don't want to be part of that.
If you are going to get out of town, 60,000 people expected to be hitting Midway on Monday. So that's going to be the busy day. I've even noticed a lot of people are out of town. Plenty of parking.
They're already
in my
gone.
Neighborhood. Yeah.
Plenty of parking. Yeah, getting here was a breeze this morning.
Right? That's what we love about
it. We are reaping the rewards of staying in town.
We are. Since we're talking about the long weekend, Courtney, and you are arts gal, anything you want to flag for folks, you know, that they might want to check out?
Oh, there's so much happening. On Saturday, the Grant Park Orchestra has its annual 4th of July concert. That is free to attend, so if you want to, you know, grab some friends, go have a picnic in Millennium Park, hear some good music, hang out by the lake. Our colleague Erica Thompson put together a whole list of everything that's happening related to the country's 250th anniversary.
Right.
So check that out. There's some free programming at the newly opened Obama Presidential Center as well.
You had me at free. So it's July 1st, Violet, and besides what's always top of mind for me on July 1st, which is Canada Day, a number of state laws just went into effect. And one that stood out to me that I want to bring up to you is a law that aims to protect students from cyberbullying. So give us the details on that.
Yeah, so it effectively adds generative AI to this, you know, list of things that can be used for cyberbullying. You know, obviously our law is adapting for the times here. Our lawmakers trying to catch up with this very rapidly, you know, advancing technology. But, you know, this is just essentially giving teachers, administrators, others in the education field more tools to combat cyberbullying by including this more explicitly. And there are some other laws, you know, with student protections going into place right now. There's another bill that was just going that just went into effect today that will also keep special education records private for students. So, you know, in line with a lot of these medical privacy bills that we've been seeing, Pritzker signing some of those on Sunday, keeping prescriptions out of the state's prescription tracker to, you know, protect people from outside legal action. Similar thing here with special education, where they're allowing students and their families to have control of those records.
Yeah. A few other new laws that go into effect today. Minimum wage in Chicago, it's going up to $17.05 an hour. The Cook County minimum wage goes up to $15.40 an hour. The state's minimum wage does not change. It's been $15 since 2025. Also, legal cocktails to go that started back in the pandemic. That's going to be permanent as of today. Real quick, what else are you keeping an eye on, Courtney?
Gosh, I'm watching the weather like we were talking about earlier. I'm looking forward, hoping we have a nice sunny weekend here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. You, Violet?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'll take any excuse to talk about baseball. Sox are doing great, but end of the month, I've got a story upcoming on this, but the Women's Baseball World Cup will be played in Rockford July 22nd through 26th. So we're going to see six international teams coming here to play.
Oh, cool.
Immediately followed by the opening day of the Women's Professional Baseball League, the first women's baseball league in 70 years in the United States, which will be played in Springfield. So Illinois hosting a lot of women's baseball this year.
Go Illinois.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
WBEZ's Claire Lane and Courtney Kippers and Violet Miller with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.